special guest, Frank Zappa. Special guest Frank Zappa. Why is that so valuable? Why did you urge me to play that, Frank Zappa?
Because it's about to become a collector's item. We found out that Ravel's Bolero is public domain in the UK and maybe a couple of other territories, but for the rest of the world it won't be public domain until the year 2003, something like that. And the publisher has demanded that I take all the other copies of Bolero off the market.
Yeah.
So I will. And I'll re-edit the album and take Bolero out.
You're just acceding to his wishes, but not willfully. You'd like to keep it on the market, would you?
Oh, of course I would. I think it's a very good version of it.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about Ravel is he left no heirs. His musical estate was left to his washerwoman, his chauffeur, and his gardener. And their heirs now control the Ravel musical estate. And I believe it is their wishes, as conveyed to us through the publisher, that this heinous work of art to be removed from the marketplace.
It's a bit, the classical music that you, or the modern classical music that you write and you are interested in, you know, Varese and a certain amount of Stravinsky and Webern, it's a lot less tuneful than Ravel's Bolero. It's a bit tuneful for you, that, isn't it?
I think that Ravel's Bolero is one of the greatest pieces of music ever written.
Mm.
But I also think that it sounds good as a reggae, and that's why I did it.
Yeah, but you go for all this dissonant stuff, all this classical.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't have much of a tune as far as I can hear.
If you're accustomed to listening to tunes, then the first time you listen to dissonant music, you'll say, that's not a tune. But you have to develop another listening process for that other kind of music.
What's that? I mean, I like a good tune.
Oh, well, most people do like a good tune, but there are other things to listen to besides tunes. There's an atmosphere that is created by certain types of harmony or absence of harmony. It's like stepping into another world, and especially in the music of Webern, where the notes are so far apart, you get to spend your time in this imaginary space that he has invented for you. It's like living in a Viennese mathematical space, is the way I listen to Webern.
It's not going to catch on, is it, to a large audience?
Why should it?
So it's elitism.
I think that the other way to look at it is, if the sole judge of musical quality is numbers of units sold, then all art would be in a lot of trouble.
Oh, yeah, that's going to the other, that's reductio ad absurdum, that's going to the other extreme, because you can be popular and good.
Well, not in America, you see, because it's almost, if you haven't sold 30 million units on one album, if it hasn't shipped mega platinum, then why are you even bothering to be in the music business? That's the general attitude there.
Shall we hear some of this? Do you want to choose some for me? Anton Webern, 1883 to 1945. And do you want to just choose one there and I'll bung one on?
Oh, I like the Six Bagatelles for String Quartet, Opus 9.
when is the best time to listen to that? When you're riding along with a surfboard on the back of the Jeep on the way to the beach.
With your surf bunny, when you really should be listening to Dick Dale. No, that's the wrong time. But if you're in England in the late fall or early spring and it's about 6 o'clock in the morning and it's raining and it's gray outside, you know, that's good atmosphere for it.
And what will you say to the people listening now? And there will inevitably be people listening now who will say, that is crap.
Well, they have the right to say that, and they certainly don't have to go out and buy it, and they should be thankful that they only listen to a few seconds of it.
Is it art?
I think so.
Yeah. You were saying if you shift units, the attitude prevalent in the USA, if you shift units, it's got to be good.
That's right.
That out and out.
That's the only criteria in the
rampant
United States.
Commercialism.
Yeah.
Are you at all bitter that over the years you haven't shifted more units?
Only if I had been more like Dick Dale. Or whatever the current fad was.
Yeah, so that would have inevitably meant compromise.
Well, it would have meant doing a completely different kind of music than what I'm doing, because they only play a certain type of music on the radio in the U.S. You have to do hit record music. And you also have to pay off large amounts of money to get it on the air in the first place, which I don't do.
Well, it's a good job that that's not the case in this country.
Yeah, well, maybe one day it will be.
No. So it's paled really bad in the States.
Yeah. You should look at a book called Hitmen.
Mm-hmm.
The facts are in there.
You're not talking with a chip on your shoulder. This is the case.
No, it's a fact.
Yeah. And the fact that your records, if your records have been played on the radio, because they're interesting records. I'm not being obsequious. They're interesting records to listen to, but they're not immediately accessible. And you said yourself that if something is good, it's not necessarily immediately accessible. But you've not gone out for out-and-out commercial records, so you tend to be blaming the media rather than the fact that the public might not like your records.
Well, the fact is that I make all different kinds of music, from the most simplistic type of dance tunes to things that sound like the Webern that you just listened to, and all stops in between. So the unfortunate thing is that the entire body of work has been left off the radio in the United States. I mean, if you were to hand me one of my normal release records, I'm sure I could find something on there that would be pop music. And
Jewish Princess.
Well, that got played.
It's surprising that got played, because it might have offended. Like, a lot of your lyrics, they're challenging, and they might have offended a lot of people.
Well, that one did offend a lot of people, but it also made a lot of other people laugh and made a lot of other people happy, because I received letters from Jewish princesses saying, at last, there's a song about me.
Let's hear it.
A nasty little Jewish princess,
la, la, la.
With long bony nails and a hairdo that rinses.
Wee.
A horny little Jewish princess, with a garlic aroma that could level Tacoma. Lonely inside. Well, she can swallow my hairy little Jewish princess,
la, la, la,
with a brand new nose,
wee,
who knows where it goes. I want a steamy little Jewish princess, with overworked gums,
who squeaks when she comes.
I don't want no troll. I just want a humanoid darling little Jewish princess,
la, la, la.
Who don't know shit about cooking and is arrogant looking. A vicious little Jewish princess, to specifically happen with a pee-pee that's snapping all up inside. I just want a princess to ride.
All right, back to the top. Everybody twist.
You don't do that song on in your act anymore, do you?
Well, first of all, I'm not touring anymore, so.
Well, are you never going to tour again?
I don't have any plans to. 88 was the last one.
And you got fed up of it and you thought, no more.
Well, I'm 50 years old. I mean, I can't just be slogging around with a guitar strung over my back singing Jewish Princess to people now, should I?
Maybe you'll come back. Maybe you'll do it again. Of course, you've got absolutely obsessed and intrigued with the technology, the musical technology of the 90s, haven't you? Like this synclavier. Tell me briefly what a synclavier is for the uninitiated.
It is a combination of a computer, a keyboard, and a very large amount of computer memory storage. And if you're a composer, it allows you to enter the data of your composition either by playing it into the keyboard or typing it on a keypad. And then you push a button and it plays back what you wrote with the sound of real instruments.
I suppose this obviates the necessity for musicians who can be a very recalcitrant and difficult breed. I mean, they're human beings and you have to pay them and...
And they have to eat and things like that. Yeah, it does... it relieves some of that pressure.
Was that a genuine and real pressure which caused you some angst?
Well, I've had some unfortunate experiences with orchestras here and there.
Mm-hmm. Or here?
And there, too. Here's an example of an unfortunate experience with an orchestra over there. The first big concert with a symphony orchestra was in 1970 with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and it was a very big success. So shortly after this concert, I was approached by the business manager of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and he said, we would like to have you write for us a concerto for two pianos and orchestra, and we will give the world premiere of this. And I thought, well, this is very nice of him. And then he said, of course, we would like to have you buy for us two Bösendorfer Grand Imperial pianos, which at that time, they were about $30,000 a piece. They're about $80,000 now. And that was the last time I talked to anybody in the Los Angeles Philharmonic.
Are they very snobbish about your music? Do you think that's a bit of a problem? Do you think that, oh, God, he's a rock star. How can we possibly work with him?
They were happy to work with me if I'd buy him two pianos. Yeah. I think that's the insulting factor there.
And this country, well-documented, it went to court, didn't it, in 1971, the Albert Hall case. They didn't want to have your soundtrack to 200 Motels perform there. Quite rightly, I mean, the Albert Hall is a prestigious and marvellous venue, and to have some American coming over and his obscene lyrics.
We'd already played it twice.
But the lyrics that you'd played previously have been quite as obscene as the lyrics of 200 Motels.
The concert that was supposed to take place for 200 Motels was 80% to be played by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra with no lyrics, and the other 20% was to be played by the rock and roll band. And we had said to the woman who had made the initial complaint, if there's something you don't want to have in there, we'd be happy to change it. So as far as I could see, there was no reason to lock the doors and keep us out, and we filed a breach of contract suit against the Albert Hall. And they tried to defend it by saying that the material was obscene, but the final judgment of the court was that the material was not obscene. Yes, the contract had been breached, but since you're an American and we're royal and we're British and we're really wonderful, why don't you just go home? You bad boy, you.
So it left you in rather, left the British in rather bad odor with yourself. And the British haven't been too popular with you ever since, as a nation, as an attitude.
Let me just make a distinction now between the Crown and her loyal subjects.
Right. Yes, I think at this point it's apt that you should do that.
But I would like to say that I think this country would be a lot better off if you had a constitution.
Mm-hmm. In what form should that constitution take? Like the American constitution?
Well, some kind of a constitution, because...
So are you saying that America is better off than Britain because America has a constitution and we don't?
No, I'm saying...
So a constitution is no guarantee of being better off, is it?
No, it's not a guarantee at all, but this country, I think, would be better off if they had a constitution. This is one case.
Mm-hmm. Were those lyrics in any way obscene?
I don't believe in lyrical obscenity. I think that the English language is a wonderful thing. And you can do a lot of interesting things with it. And there's no word in it that should be barred from usage. The whole idea that hearing or reading any word is going to cause your brain to explode or cause your soul to suddenly go plunging toward the depths of Hades as soon as the word is uttered, that's ridiculous.
Well, Frank Zappa with me in the studio says that no word should be hidden from usage. That's a point I'd like to explore. Right now, here's... another of his older Meisterwerks. This is Don't Eat the Yellow Snow.
Dreamed I was an Eskimo. Mm-hmm. around my toe. Frost that bit the ground below. Was 100 degrees below zero. And my mama cried. And my mama cried. Money, don't go to the show. Well, I turned around and I said, ho, ho. Well, I turned around and I said, ho, ho. Well, I turned around and I said, ho, ho. And the northern lights commenced to glow. And she said, with a tear,
watch out where the huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow. Watch out where the huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow.
Frank Zappa is with me. We just heard Don't Eat the Yellow Snow. Now, that you don't think that any single word, we're talking about obscenity, and I know you've taken a stand on this against that group that has been imputed with being called the moral majority in the state. No word should be hidden from usage from anyone. Right. Now, that's what about those nasty little words that will corrupt young people and they'll start using them and then the English language will become completely defiled and as will our morals?
Well, in the United States, the language is getting defiled through bad usage rather than bad words. Mm-hmm. So the more words you use, the better off you are.
Yes, but these specific words that I'm sure people know, you think it's quite all right for them to be bandied about? You don't think there should be a line drawn, you know, like a watershed on television, no words off before 10 o'clock at night?
No, why? Tell me, where is the harm?
Would you like to look at a three-year-old walking around saying F you and F this and F that? Would you feel quite comfortable with that?
I have no problem with that.
Interesting views. And you're standing for president, aren't you?
I'm looking into it. I haven't announced that I'm a candidate yet, but if the research goes well, I may.
Mm-hmm. The research being what?
Well, it's a feasibility study. One of the problems that I'm facing is I want to run as an anti-partisan candidate. I don't want to be associated with any party. And because the U.S. system has something called the Electoral College, I don't know legally how a candidate who has no party affiliation would be able to have representation in the Electoral College, because it is the Electoral College that actually chooses the president,
yes.
Not the popular vote.
It's a very complicated system over
yes,
there.
Yes, and they kept it that way so that they could keep it that way.
And what's the point, apart from standing for president and making it perfectly acceptable for three-year-olds to go around effing and blinding? Mm-hmm. What is the point? Because in this country, when we have elections and by-elections, there are a small coterie of people. There's a guy called Screaming Lord Sutch from the Monster Raving Loony Party, and they stand in all the elections and they've got no chance of being elected. And the only reason they do it is from bizarre inner need that perhaps Freud could explain, to draw attention to themselves. Mm-hmm. Is that why you're standing?
No. Any other questions?
Yeah, why are you standing?
Because the United States is a mess, and I don't see either of the parties offering any concrete solutions to the problems that we have in the country. The one thing that I have to offer is I don't owe anything to anybody, and one of the reasons why things don't get done now is the candidates in both the other parties owe a lot of favors to a lot of people, and so nothing really gets done.
We got a impression over here that from watching the news and so forth that there was a lot of popular support for the Gulf War in America.
Well, you would have that impression simply because the news was managed. There were many, many anti-war demonstrations in the United States, and there was a standing rule on network television that they were not to be covered.
Seriously?
Yes.
Who imposed that rule?
Who do you think? Somebody from the White House. There was a governmental agency that was set up by Ronald Reagan called the Department of Domestic Diplomacy, and the goal of this organization is to manage the news.
That's like some George Orwell. That's 1984.
Well,
this is the greatest democracy in the world, the USA.
Says who?
The land of the brave.
Yeah,
free?
Well, yeah. The land of the people who need to feel good about themselves because they blew up a bunch of Iraqis. I think that it's shameful.
Yeah, but then Saddam had to be dealt with, didn't he?
But Saddam could have been dealt with diplomatically before that ever happened. I mean, if you trace back the whole history of the Gulf War, you'll see that there were a number of events that occurred before he actually moved into Kuwait where somebody in the administration sent exactly the wrong signal to this man. Because prior to that time, Saddam had been protected by the U.S. government. There were a number of pieces of legislation that had been proposed in the Senate to stop sending him weapons and to try and bring his military machine under control. And the administration stopped these pieces of legislation. He was totally protected. He was our pal.
So the whole thing was served to reinforce America's self-images or American self-image as sort of macho, Rambo-type leaders of the world, and you don't push us around, buddy.
I think there's a lot of reasons why it occurred, but one of the worst things that seems to be showing up now is you remember all this talk about the fragile coalition that George had managed to put together? Well, you had to pay to get in to the fragile coalition. You either had to send troops or you had to guarantee money. And the payback was, at the end of the conflict, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was dishing out the contracts for rebuilding Kuwait and probably will dish them out for rebuilding Iraq, too. And now you have all these nations who contributed to the war effort as part of the fragile coalition standing around saying, where's my contracts? So it's a rather grim business. And when I see people in the United States lining up down Main Street to see tanks rolling through America and missile launchers rolling through America with yellow ribbons dangling on them and bands playing and all this rather old-fashioned hoopla, people pretending to feel good about themselves while there are 3 million homeless and hospital emergency wards closing because there's not enough money to keep them open and all this kind of stuff, and they're spending millions of dollars on parades for feeling good about yourself while members of the coalition are going, where's my contract? This is not good.
I'd love to hear this guy in the hustings against George Bush and Michael Dukakis or whoever runs for the Democrats next time. It's Frank Zappa with me, hopes to run for the president. He's doing the research at the moment to see if it's a feasible operation. And it would be interesting to hear some of these views exposed to the people in the States, because there isn't much radicalism in politics over there on the front line, is there?
I don't think there's much disagreement between the two parties, which is one of the reasons why I don't want to have anything to do with either of them. I've been a member of the Democratic Party all my life, and I keep waiting for them to stand up and actually be different than the Republicans. But what has happened since Reagan got in, they've created this imperial presidential style where every event is a photo opportunity with millions of balloons being let off and banners draped everywhere. It's very stagecrafty, and it's very expensive. And the Republicans have the money to mount the stagecraft and to make sure that the news media shows only the proper angle at the event and everything is fine and perfect. And the Democrats can't afford to do this, so they always look like bumpkins when they come up against that kind of stagecraft. And over the last 10 years or so, they've become envious of it. And when it's time to make a political speech, they all start to talk like Republicans. And so how do you tell the difference?
You're a communist.
I'm not a communist, no way. Communism is a system. They always complain about capitalism, saying in capitalism you have winners and losers, but in communism you have only losers.
It's Nicky McCarthy Campbell with Frank Zappa. Here is Jazz from a Hell.
Thank you.
Jazz from Hell there, and Frank Zappa, the creator of that piece of music, is with me. Did you create that on this gizmo, this contraption we were talking about earlier on, the synclavier?
Yes. And that particular song got a Grammy, so that just goes to show you how fake the Grammys are, because you can imagine that nobody in the Grammy committee ever listened to that piece of music.
Well, they must have to have awarded you it.
I don't think so.
You're just being ungrateful and ungracious, aren't you?
No.
Well, are you saying that particular piece of music that we've just heard doesn't deserve an award?
Well, certainly not the best cut on that album. I think there are probably two or three others on that album that are much better than that. I can't imagine why they chose that, because it was never played on the air in the United States. And it just seems incongruous that they gave me an award for it.
You've got very eclectic musical interests, and the subject matter of your songs over the years has been interesting too. This fascination with the groupies that you used to have, no longer with you, presumably, since you don't tour anymore. But why was this? I suppose it was a sort of vicarious interest in sex as well, which comes through in a lot of your songs.
Well, to do songs about activities of groupies within a body of work that kind of represents a diary of the times as we went our way from one social revolution into the other, I think that it's appropriate that there were some songs about groupies, because they did exist, continue to exist in a different form, I think.
And why in a different form? They insist on condoms now, or what?
I don't know. The whole motivation when they first began seems to me a little bit different, because the groups that they're chasing after are a little bit different.
How were they different?
In the early days, the groups were actually interested in saying something. Today, they're very interested in creating a piece of product which will be easily connected with another product, which will then yield an endorsement.
And shift units.
Shift big units.
So in the early days, the good old days, all those groups in the 60s weren't interested in selling records?
No, they were. They were interested in selling records, but the record was what was important, not the commercial tie-in with the beer, the soda pop, or the tennis shoes. And I think today you have a situation where a lot of people who write songs have one eye on its secondary usage and may shape the song or the album itself so that it becomes more adaptable to that commercial application.
But getting back to groupies, they still have an eye, the other eye, perhaps, on getting laid, don't they? So why has that changed?
Well, it's not all about getting laid. It's also a matter of keeping a scorecard of who you are being laid by, or what other perks came with the sexual encounter.
What sort of? So no perks came with the sexual encounter. It was just good, honest, you come backstage, meet the rest of the band, but first of all, you've got to do this for me. That was the deal in the old days, was it?
Well, what you're describing has more to do with the way in which roadies get laid.
Mm-hmm.
And
not group members.
Group members wouldn't usually do it that way. I mean, what you're describing is the no head, no backstage pass syndrome. And I think that probably still exists, because over the years, roadies have become more and more successful at finding their own entertainment.
Howard, in fact, we had a guy on the tour bus in 1984 that we called Jabba the Prong, who used to actually pimp off all the rest of the guys in the crew. It was just, you know, there was no logical reason why this man should be so expert at it, but it seemed that we had one of the happiest crews on the road due to the efforts of Jabba.
So did the roadies provide the girls, or did you...
Usually for themselves. Usually the sort of girls that like to go with a roadie are not exactly the kinds of girls that the members of the band would like, unless, of course, he's a drummer.
What sort of... how did you procure, as a member of the band and the other members of the band, your companions, then? Different methods.
If you look at the film 200 Motels, there's an interesting part in there that shows... the imaginary members of an imaginary band getting ready to meet an imaginary bunch of groupies in an imaginary nightclub, where they're all seated at these little makeup tables, preparing themselves for their evening experience. And the alarm bell goes off, and you find that they weren't makeup tables. They were actually chutes, like at a horse race. And they all dash through, and they go to the club. But before going to the club, they're saying things like... I buffed my nails. One guy says I moistened my lips. Another one said I did this, I did that. Everybody figures out his own way to find the imaginary girl of his dreams wherever he goes shopping.
Right, here's something from 200 Motels. There's a song that there are songs there about groupies, aren't there?
Yeah.
What's it called again?
How about Shove It Right In?
She chooses all the
There was also a song called Crew Sluts, wasn't there?
Yeah. That's about roadies.
Is that...
Hey, 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 all you girls in these industrial towns. I know you're probably getting tired of all the local clowns. They never give you no respect. They never treat you nice. One of the lines is, trade your spot on the bench for a guy with a wrench and be a crew slut.
What about the accusation that the music is always interesting, but the lyrics are pretty puerile?
Well, the only person who could say that is a person who hasn't listened to all the albums. I mean, basically, when people say that, it's a recitation of reviews of albums of the 60s and 70s, and I would say that there's no question that some of the songs that are on those albums, when they deal specifically with sex
or deal with the type of sociology that one finds inside of a rock and roll band, a certain mentality would find that to be puerile. But the largest percentage of what I write about is not that. In fact, I think it's probably 40% of the catalog, maybe even 50% is instrumental. Mm-hmm. And of the other lyrics, there are plenty of things dealing with politics or issues which are not puerile.
Right, I'd like to hear that one, Crew Sluts, actually. Here it is, from Joe's Garage, or Garage, as we say over here.
Hey, 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 all you girls in these industrial towns. I know you're probably getting tired of all the local clowns. They never give you no respect, they never treat you nice.
Of life.
Be a crew slut.
See the world. Don't make a fuss, just get on the bus.
Crew slut.
And water makes its own sauce.
Be a crew slut.
So you don't forget, call before midnight tonight. The boys and the crew are just waiting for you.
Get to move around, you never go nowhere. I know you're probably getting tired of all the guys out there. You always wondered what it's like to go from place to place. So darling, take a little ride.
Footprints.
Be a crew slut.
Hey, you'll love it.
Be a crew slut.
It's a way of life. I ain't gonna squash it, and you don't need to wash it.
Crew slut.
Hey, I'll buy you a pizza.
Be a crew slut.
Of course, I'll introduce you to Warren. The boys and the crew are only waiting for you.
You were virulently anti-drugs, I know, throughout the 60s, when everybody else was smoking and dropping and snorting and sniffing.
And twirling.
And twirling.
And dying.
And dying.
And puking.
You.
And mutating.
You're mutating.
And then all the people who took LSD turned into yuppies. And I said, now there is a dangerous drug.
Some of those people who took LSD must be working in the White House and high in American politics
Wall
now.
Street.
Mm.
Yeah.
Is that one of the big problems, you think, with the... American society?
Well, I said in an interview a few years ago, if you want an example of a dangerous drug, the worst one would have to be LSD, because first of all, it was developed as a chemical warfare drug, because it was designed to alter people's consciousness and make them a weaker enemy. And in order to test this drug and find it out whether it would really do in the public domain what they thought it would do in the laboratory, they had to use it on large numbers of people. So they found this wonderful plan. They would sell it to their victims for the study. And so a lot of people bought LSD, voluntarily participated in the study, and the net result was we got a generation of yuppies out of it. And so if you look at what the yuppies have done for the world, you can see what a dangerous drug LSD turned out to be.
What did you think at the time of people who were twirling and puking and whirling around? And
so long as they didn't twirl and puke and whirl on me, it's their business, you know. You want to twirl and puke? Go ahead. Just keep it off my shoes.
Did you... You exerted discipline, though, didn't you? You were a disciplinarian as a band leader. If any...
No question about it. The rule in the band was, you get wasted, you're fired. Because I'm paying you money to play music, because people are paying money to buy tickets. And when you go on stage, you play music. Also means you have to show up for the job. And also means you have to be able to go through customs without being arrested.
Yeah.
And so...
Did you have any hassles like that?
Oh, yeah. A couple of times. And some people lost their jobs over it.
And it would reflect on you, of course, because they'd
say you... Well, it's not their name that goes in the paper. There was one case when we came to London, and a couple of the guys The police broke into their rooms at the Holiday Inn and found some minuscule quantity of hash in the possession of Tommy Mars and Ike Willis, and these guys were hustled off to the police station without their shoes and without their glasses, and they made a big deal out of it. And the next day, as we're leaving the country, I'm seeing my name all over the papers. Mm. You know, it's a Frank Zappa band member is arrested. But, you know, that, and that's what happens.
So they think you're a hash-crazed lunatic.
Yeah. Mm. Well.
But then, I mean,
who writes puerile lyrics?
Yeah. But then there we are. I mean, right in front of you, there's another deadly weed, isn't there? And you smoked about three of them during the interview.
I'm gonna probably smoke another 10 before we're done. Now, I like tobacco. Always have, and always will.
But that's a drug, isn't it?
Well, I don't know whether it really is classified as a drug.
Well,
it's not a controlled substance.
Mm. Some people argue that hash is a lot less harmful than tobacco.
Well, it depends on what you expect to be doing after you smoke it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think that twirling and puking is a productive lifestyle, I think that you can indulge in whatever kind of preparation you want. I usually don't twirl and puke after I smoke these. In the United States, we get these messages from a man called C. Everett Koop. Remember the Surgeon General, the Admiral of Health? The same man who told us that AIDS came from a green monkey in East Africa?
Where did AIDS come from?
We don't know for sure, but there have been some indications that it crawled out of a bottle in somebody's laboratory. There's a certain amount of documentation to back it up, because it was actually the idea of creating an agent which would be, how was it put? Detrimental is not the right word, but a word like that to the human immunological system.
Deleterious.
Yeah, probably one of those. I can't remember the exact word, but it's from the Congressional Record. There was a hearing where somebody was asking for funding to create such a preparation. This was in the around 71.
That's absolutely astonishing. It's like something out of science fiction.
Well, if you
the Satan bug was that. Really?
If you get a book called A Higher Form of Killing, and I think it's page 243, you'll see what I'm talking about.
So what was the end result? What was the aim of this drug? To actually rinse out from society all forms of sexual depravity?
No, it was being discussed in the context of agents which were ethnically specific. They were also discussing creating agents that would seek out a target racial group. And one of the examples was given. They were trying to get money to develop agents that would look for certain target genes or other attributes in certain ethnic groups, and then once that target had been located, then the evil doings of the organism or the chemical would be only specific to that group. And one of the examples they gave was the Blackfoot Indian tribe had mostly A positive blood type, and so if you wanted to get rid of all the Blackfeet Indian people, you would develop something that would first look for that specific blood type, and then, you know, a few other little duties would have to be fulfilled, and then it would kill just them. And it's not too far-fetched, because you don't see very many Irish people with sickle cell anemia. And so if a person wanted to harm a large segment of a black population, they would probably develop something that looked for anyone who was likely to have a predisposition to sickle cell anemia. And so you could target that particular ethnic group. And then there's Tay-Sachs disease, which is common to a certain group of Jews. And so, you know, there are people who sit around thinking about this stuff and figuring out how to do genocide.
Are you just putting the spooks up us late at night, or do you actually believe it then?
Oh, I believe it. Yeah.
Here's Promiscuous, Frank Zappa.
Once upon a time, must have been round October a few years back, in one of those top-secret laboratories the government keeps stashed away underneath Virginia, a evil prince, occasionally employed as a part-time theatrical criticizer, set to working on a plot for the systematic genocidical removalance of all unwanted, highly rhythmic individuals and sissy boys. Your cocksucker done woofed up a secret potion. And right along with it, the atrocious idea that what he been boiling up down there just might be the final solution to the white man biting, if you acquires my drift. Well, he was sure he had a good thing going, but there was always the possibility that something might fuck up. So he planned to have a little test just to check it all out before he dump it in the water supply. Shortly then after, with high-level government corroboration, he arranged to have a goodwill visit to San Quentin, along with some country western musicians, and sprinkle a little bit of it on some of the boys.